Hello, this is Dr. Gary Sherman, the Heart Guy, and I welcome you to our exciting and informative podcast titled The Heart Guy Presents The Heart of the Matter. Bring you interesting discussions and conversations related to the vast and important subjects of heart disease, heart failure, and organ donation, and everything related to that in today's ever-changing world. I'm extremely honored to have as my special guest today an inspiring contributor to our global heart transplant community, Dr. Nandini Nair. Dr. Nair received her PhD in biochemistry from the Indian Institute of Science in Bangalore, India in 1987. She then went on to George's University School of Medicine in Grenada, West Indies, attaining her medical degree in the year 2000. Dr. Nair then moved to my second city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and attended Drexel University College of Medicine, just steps away from my dental school alma mater at University of Pennsylvania, to complete her residency in internal medicine. Dr. Nair was not done there and traveled across the country to Stanford University, where she received a fellowship in vascular medicine in 2004, and then back to Drexel for a cardiology fellowship from 2004 through 2007. She returned to Palo Alto and Stanford, attaining a fellowship in advanced heart failure and transplant cardiology by 2008. Dr. Nair worked on her executive master's in healthcare leadership at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island from 2009 to 2021 and is currently a medical director of advanced heart failure, mechanical circulatory support, and cardiac transplantation at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center. Wow. Dr. Nair, welcome to The Heart Guy Presents The Heart of the Matter.
Thank you, Dr. Sherman, and answer some of your questions.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. We can start off. So I will tell you, start out with the fact that much of my speaking platform from which The Heart Guy Presents The Heart of the Matter podcast was derived is centered on congestive heart failure. And may I call on you at this time in getting our conversation started for our many listeners to ask you how you define congestive heart failure?
Well, that's a very good question. So from my perspective, congestive heart failure is just something that results from the heart not functioning well. So any aspect of volume overload can be construed as congestive heart failure. And as we all know, there are two types. There's heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, where just a problem not with the contractility of the heart, but just relaxation. So it's not filling so much. So when it doesn't fill that much, we tend to eject out a lower volume, and then we have a lower cardiac output, which results in a very similar symptomatic pattern like heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, which is something that comes to everybody's mind, where the heart's not pumping, it's big, it's baggy, it's no longer doing what it should do, and people get fluid overloaded. So any etiology or any cause for heart failure will lead to volume overload and pressure, and eventually if not treated appropriately, we can lead to multi-organ failure. In fact, untreated CHF, as we call it, congestive heart failure, causes about 50% mortality at 5 years. So you can see how this disease is so insidious, which people would just dismiss as edema that will go away, but it never does. So heart failure is not like wine or anything. It doesn't get better with time. And if we do that, we can prolong life for a very long time.
Yeah. And as you said, it's progressive. That is, it tends to get worse over time and not better, certainly. You mentioned ejection fraction. So for those people who are not familiar with that term, could you make that a little clearer?
Sure, yeah. So ejection fraction is just the amount of blood that the heart's pumping out to the rest of the body. So it's usually a percentage, and normally it's around 70%. And it just tells you how much blood is ejected or just put out into the other organ system, which helps with the perfusion. So if your heart's not pumping out enough blood, then obviously there's not enough blood going to the other organs and they all shut down. So ejection fraction is something that is mathematically calculated from any of the imaging studies like echocardiography or cardiac MRI or even CT, where we look at the volume of blood that's left behind versus the volume of blood that's pushed out, and then it is mathematically calculated to tell us what efficiency is at which the heart is operating. So it's actually a measure of the heart's efficiency to pump blood.
Yeah, I remember sometimes the surprised look on some of my doctor's faces when suddenly my ejection fraction went from, say, 50% down to closer to 35%. The worst it ever got for me was 24%, but that was, you know, obviously when I became more severe in my congestive heart failure. I functioned a long time, somewhere between 45 and 35, but I think it gets to a point where it gets impossible to function properly without help. Yeah.
Plenty of symptoms at that point, like dizziness, nausea, lack of appetite, because there's no flow of blood to the gut.
Yeah, it's not an easy disease. It's really very uncomfortable.
I can
tell you that personally, and I know for many of our, and by the way, it's like 6.2 million people in this country have it. So, you know, it's not something that can be ignored, even though a lot of people don't understand it. It affects many people, perhaps one in four people in their lifetime get it.
Yes, one in five, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a lot.
The lifetime risk is always around 20%, yeah.
Wow. A cornerstone to treating heart failure is guideline-derived medical therapy. So what is guideline-derived or guideline-directed medical therapy, and how does this therapy benefit the majority of patients with heart failure?
So the guideline-derived medical therapy has evolved over the last 30 years, I think. Initially, when people saw heart failure and edema or swelling, they just gave them some water pills, as everybody would say, which were diuretics, and pulled the fluid off. That was when we did not know the pathophysiology and mechanisms which operate in heart failure. So over the time, it became very clear that's not the only thing to do, but there are several other systems in the body that are malfunctioning due to heart failure. One of the important things is sympathetic nervous system. So when heart failure begins, the sympathetic nervous system actually goes up. It gets upregulated, or what would you say? It gets revved up, and that is one part of the problem. Then there is the renin-angiotensin, which actually is a system that works closely with the sympathetic nervous system. And that system is also biochemically activated. So you have several pathways of biochemistry that's going on in the person's body that's upregulated. So if you don't hit every pathway with drugs, you will not get a total effect. So we have now the beta blockers to calm down the sympathetic nervous system, and with the renin-angiotensin system and the other aldosterone systems, we have other drugs like ACE inhibitors, ARBs, which are angiotensin receptor blockers, and then we have the aldosterone receptor blockers too. So if you can accomplish slowly and steadily blocking all of these pathways by simultaneously using these medications, then the progression of the disease can be slowed down, especially if you're in the early stages. But one of the caveats of not being able to achieve this is that when somebody is in profound heart failure, their blood pressure is in fact very low. A lot of these medications that we give to prevent the upregulation of sympathetic nervous system and other biochemical pathways is to lower. It has an effect on blood pressure. So if the pressure is too low to begin with, we cannot add all the medications that are required for accomplishing guideline-derived medical therapy. But we make every attempt in every patient to actually do that in order to accomplish maximum medical benefit with medical therapy.
So two things have happened there. One is, first, the body is trying to compensate for the heart failure, which is the first part of the problem. And the second part of the problem is that some of the medications that would be used to help that will actually reduce an already low blood pressure.
Yes.
Interesting.
We actually have a lot of parameters we look at when we are looking at the blood work for heart failure patients. And in my office, I get blood work every time the patient comes in, so I can monitor the kidneys, the liver, the electrolyte imbalances such as sodium, potassium, magnesium, and even the thyroid function, because the thyroid gland is very much involved in regulating metabolism and also in regulating pathways which will affect the heart.
My goodness. Yeah, so many systems are needed to be monitored. And I know this when I was in the hospital and even outside it, now that I'm an outpatient. But basically, I have to see the hepatologist, you know, and I have to, they're always watching my kidneys naturally. I have a cardiomems, so they watch the fluid build up and the sodium intake for me. And it's all connected, basically, you know, the kidneys especially and the heart are so closely aligned. So it's not just the heart, as you suggest.
No, it's a multi-organ disease.
Yeah, it's devastating. It's been shared with me in my discussions with my doctors up in heart failure, surgeons, even the nurse practitioners, the transplant coordinators up there in the hospital, that perhaps their major pain point, if you will, is that oftentimes cardiologists do not send the patients soon enough to the heart failure departments. So, you know, I think you would agree with that. So what are the red flags which signify that it's time to refer to a heart failure specialist?
So, yeah, no, I try and educate people on this. And in fact, we at Texas Tech, the Division of Cardiology, we run a course. I actually direct the course every year on updates in advanced heart failure. And this is one of the topics we do. It's a CME course for physicians, nurse practitioners of all disciplines, and other paramedical and paramedical staff. So what we tell them is that we actually enumerate the red flags at which time we should, or even slightly earlier, we should send patients. First thing is look at the electrolytes. So sodium is an important thing. Low sodium due to increased volume is a very easy thing you can look at and find. And if that keeps happening, then we need to see a heart failure specialist. Number two is the kidney function, the creatinine. If that's going up, serious problems there because of perfusion. Because whenever you tank a lot of fluid, there's a lot of congestion, and the congestion backs up everywhere. And venous congestion is one of the important things for kidney failure. And if there is kidney failure and this pressure and congestion on the nephrons for a long time, they will just die out. So even after you have good perfusion, the kidneys may not come back. So we don't want to get there. So if we see creatinine going up, they should go to the heart failure specialist. And then the liver enzymes are extremely important, because if you tank fluid, it backs up into the liver and you get congestive hepatopathy, which is very bad, and it can cause what's called cardiac cirrhosis in the long term and then do a real damage to the liver. So having said this, and then there is confusion setting in these patients with very poor perfusion to the brain. So there are several red flags that you can see just in your blood work, and that will prompt you to send the patient immediately to an advanced heart failure center so they can start taking care of this patient.
Right. So is there confusion? Because when the cardiologists will see some of these red flags, they then will attempt to treat the patients on their own without first sending them to heart failure right away, I would guess. Mostly because they think they could probably prescribe the medications themselves.
Yes, I mean, that's one thing, definitely. And the field of advanced heart failure transplant cardiology is pretty young. Also one thing, but now we have enough advanced heart failure transplant board certified cardiologists, so there should be no excuse to send patients.
Yeah, I was going to say the emphasis on collaboration.
Collaboration is a big thing, and we need to learn to have a multidisciplinary approach, especially with heart failure transplant. We have to be collaborative with physicians, surgeons, pharmacists, social workers, and it takes a village. And if we do that, the patient outcomes will be much better. So I think that's the main thing. And heart failure transplant boards started only in 2010. So it's a fairly young field. My mentor, Dr. Sharon Hunt, was in fact the first person who actually recognized that cardiologists need to be involved in the care of these patients post-transplant, and then on began emphasis on training physicians, cardiologists to transplant cardiology, and then the field then slowly and steadily evolved, and now we have several programs offering this as a fourth-year fellowship. But that did not start until maybe a decade ago. Yeah, so we are still young field, but we have enough specialists for people to refer. And what happens is that when patients have low blood pressure, they stop all the medications and back off. And what that does is very detrimental to the patient, because then they would start going into more heart failure. There comes a point they're full of fluid and they cannot treat them. And that's when we get called or sent to us. So these red flags have to be recognized and sent off immediately to where they belong.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And it's sort of a balance. I mean, it's a very delicate balance, because, you know, between watching all the symptoms and giving the right medications at the right time becomes really important.
Yes. Timing, you know.
Timing, yeah.
Because if we let them go too far, they will be then not even a candidate for mechanical devices or cardiac transplantation. Mm. And then you're looking at multi-organ transplants and the age becomes a problem. It's just an endless can of worms.
Yeah, yeah. So if the patient is lucky enough to have been with a cardiologist that recognizes the disease, and they're sent to a heart failure department, which would be the proper thing to do. As the congestive heart failure progresses, there comes a point where the medication is not doing the trick. And I have this as a personal experience, where finally the Entresto and the medications that I was on are no longer helping the symptoms in the way that I would need them to be. And then it's time to consider mechanical circulatory support or heart transplantation. So when is that point? When do you reach that point?
Well, I tend to be pretty aggressive. And if I see even the creatinine slowly moving in the wrong direction, or patients getting readmitted into the hospital more frequently, then it's time to look at inotropic therapy as a bridge to mechanical support or cardiac transplant. I do have a lot of patients on Melrenone as an outpatient, and that helps them for some time, but I do tell them this is only a temporary fix. We need to run to the next stage. And in my own experience, I think putting in an LVAD earlier is much better than later. And I have had no trouble with people that we've added it with an Intermax 4, you know, which is a stage of heart failure where you're not totally continuously on an inotrope. So if you vad them at that stage, and I have a few in my pool here, and I've had no trouble at all with those guys. They don't have kidney failure, they don't have liver failure, and they chug along until they receive a heart transplant, or some of them cannot be transplanted because of antibodies, but they have a good quality of life.
Yeah, and because the body is then supported or perfused with oxygen with the help of the LVAD, they actually get into pretty good shape if they stay with an LVAD for quite a long time. Yeah, and again, I feel great with my LVAD. I feel a lot better now than I did a year ago. I've had my LVAD since January 2019.
Yes.
And there's not a lot I can't do. So it's pretty amazing. I realize that I'm depending on this pump to be in the condition that I'm in. And it may not necessarily be the end point, but it really does give you back a quality of life that was so much better than when I had even mild or moderate congestive heart failure.
It definitely helps. And the earlier we do that, the better. I mean, it does have its disadvantages a little bit, but I think if we want to preserve the organs, we should do it earlier.
Yeah.
Because then we end up with one organ transplant rather than multiple or two or whatever. So the kidneys are so, so important. And if that goes beyond a certain stage of retrieval, then we are not looking at mechanical support. Then you have to look for transplant.
Yeah, so a patient who's on dialysis, for example, would not be eligible for an LVAD?
Not really. Mm-hmm. That's why we want to catch them before they get there. Now, I had a patient in my career who had an LVAD and then got onto dialysis. And that one, we then shifted from just a heart to a heart kidney transplant. And he was in his 40s and he did extremely well. So, but we don't want to get there as much as possible because it's easier with less organs.
So what are the factors that determine eligibility for mechanical circulatory support and distinguished from those who would be recommended for cardiac transplant?
So if they are, so some people just don't like a pump. They don't want to be tethered to it. It's patient.
Yeah, I know people like that.
Yeah, because I quite understand. I completely understand that. And so that's patient preference. And then most people can be can receive an LVAD, but if their kidneys are down and stuff, it's better to look at a double organ or at least an organ transplant. I would not, especially after a certain point. In our hospital, we do not really VAD anyone with creatinine over 3.
Right. Right, right. You can reverse it. Is there an age at which you wouldn't VAD somebody?
No, actually not. We have quite a few 70-some-year-olds. They're all good.
Yeah, they're all
good. Yeah, I mean, of them had a bit of a trouble getting back into on their feet and stuff, but not really. They've done well. The oldest I have is 74 now. He got his pump when he was 72. He had a bit of a problem, but then on his face fine. So we have a lot of people in their 70s. They are usually destination, but now, but I've also seen the other aspects when I was training. We have actually transplanted older individuals. So because the older individuals have less chances of rejection, but then they can have more chances of malignancy because you're not immunosuppressing.
Yeah, right.
But still, the organ works well if the patient is capable of taking care of it and has good support.
Wow. Yeah, they have to respect that gift if they get it. That's for sure. And going back to the point about the acceptance of the LVAD and people that don't like it. What I noticed when I was in our support groups after I got my LVAD, and I was in there with a lot of people, and another misconception that a lot of people have is that this is a disease of older people. In fact, I would say at least half of the people that were in there were under 40 years old, some in their 30s even.
Yes.
And so what I noticed, though, is that the younger patients, especially when I would go up on the floors to the nurses would like pre-COVID, of course, I would go up on the floors and encourage patients who were going through these or expected to go through these operations. The younger people would have a tougher time accepting the LVAD because I think just emotionally, they hadn't had their life yet. So they, the idea of having a cable coming out of their stomach or wearing batteries, they would think, A, they couldn't work anymore or nobody would want to marry them. A lot of the problems that I, as an older person, didn't bother me because I had already lived most of my life, happily.
Yes.
And I had gone through that stuff. So for me, it was more about the LVAD giving me a second chance at life, where as younger people didn't really see it that way. So it was interesting.
Yes, and I think there are some fashionable shirts.
No question.
That are available now.
I play golf.
So that they don't show their batteries out, nothing.
That's right. Well, my wife will tell you I like showing it because I like to strike up the conversation, and I think the to make people aware of the disease is not a bad thing. But you're right. I can hide it in a vest when I play golf. Most people don't realize I'm even wearing it.
Yes.
So there's some good things that they've come up with to keep the vanity going on the part of the patients. So that's funny for sure. So what parameters do you use to decide if a patient will be a bridge to transplant or destination therapy?
Oh, the main thing on the medical factors would be if they're actively smoking and stuff, we encourage them to stop. And they have to be clean in our system at least for a year before we consider transplant. So those can be added and they'll just wait as a bridge.
It's amazing that people don't want to give up smoking, right?
Oh, no, there are quite a few smoking and chewing. And in this part of the country, there are people who use tobacco like gum. It's some kind of a chewing habit. They call it dipping. And it is, so you have to ask them specifically, are you using tobacco? If you ask them if they're smoking, they would say no. But because they're not really smoking, but they're exposed to tobacco and nicotine through the dipping.
Yeah.
So we don't, because nicotine is so angiogenic, it's not a good thing to have it in the system, and it really stimulates any type of cancer. Then if they've had any kind of malignancy, they have to wait 5 years in remission, except prostate, which I think you can undergo after 3 years, but it has to be years of remission, not post-treatment. So those are the major factors. Then some people are destination because they have panel reactive antibodies. They have a lot of them and they will never get a match and they cannot be transplanted. And the methods of desensitizing these patients are not well standardized or not practiced in a lot of centers. So those guys remain as destination. They're not bridge to transplant. So yeah, those are the medical things. And then, of course, if you think they are not going to do well taking their medications and stuff, and you see non-compliance even early on, then I think we should not waste an oral.
Yeah, interesting. And that's a judgment call.
Yes, it depends on the physicians and the committee. I mean, not just the physicians, the committee.
Yeah, it's interesting. The committee has to decide. Yeah, it's tough because and a lot of that has to be subjective. I don't know that artificial intelligence will have an answer for that because, you know, medicine is a personal specialty as much as the artificial intelligence can probably come up statistically with the best matches and the, you know, and take away some of the selection burden from the doctors. There's still the treatment of the patient and the prediction of who is going to be cooperative when they get the gift of a heart. And that's something that you have to really know your patients to make those decisions. That's interesting.
Also, I think some of us are more compassionate or more lenient, I would say, with these things in the sense I just don't believe that you can look at family support pre-transplant or pre-vad and think that will continue to happen post. If I think the patient can take care of themselves, I think they should be given a chance because I've seen family support vanish post-transplant and post-VAD, and people have lived much better. Okay, you know, so I think sometimes you have to totally look at the patient as a whole and see how they are. If they are compliant and stuff, I think they should be given a second chance.
Yeah, you mentioned the families and how it wears down on some families, even breaks them apart at times. Yeah, it's very interesting. I think there's a lot of room to be able to for a need for support of the caregivers because I think emotionally they probably go through more than the patient themselves.
Yes,
so we have to find
absolutely
a way.
And you know what I think happens is that these caregivers don't really understand how intense this is. And then it suddenly falls on them. So to avoid that, I insist that my patients speak with other patients and their families who have received an LVAD or a transplant and know the patient perspective because I think we as physicians can stand here and say a number of things. But to get the real perspective, I think they have to talk to another person who's undergone the process.
Yeah.
And that really helps. And there's some bonding between the families and that helps them.
Yeah, it's important. That's great information. Yeah, I'm involved, fortunately, in a lot of support groups online, Facebook groups, and it's only getting better, thankfully. And I'm glad I'm doing this podcast because I think it's helped a lot of people understand and be together as a community and share some of these ideas together in the groups that I've tried to form myself. But it is a grassroots effort. Everybody has to do their part. And if everybody does their part, you know, it'll get better and better and there'll be more awareness. So I think everybody just has to do their best to listen and try and help the people that are going through this. So it's so interesting to be a part of this evolution of treating heart failure. So where do you suppose we're going to go from here? That is to ask, how might treatment of advanced heart failure patients look in the immediate future?
We are developing more medical therapies, device therapies. So the ACC guidelines actually tell us if somebody has dyssynchrony, we should put pacemaker, which is biventricular, so we can resynchronize the heart. They should undergo resynchronization therapy, and we should watch it and see if they're getting better. If they're getting better, they don't need anything else. So those kind of devices will evolve, which are less intense. And then there are the stimulators and a whole lot of things in the pipeline that could provide some amount of relief and maybe some recovery. So myocardial recovery would be one of the things that will be an important area of investigation, and it currently is. Then the other aspect would be totally internal, total artificial hearts, which are driven like pacemakers with batteries which are internal. If that happens, then some of these people I told you, because of antibodies, cannot get a real heart. Those people would definitely benefit from those kind of devices.
If they get an artificial, a totally artificial heart, they might live to 150.
You never know. The engineering, the biomedical engineering.
Yeah, but then they'll be bad on the roads. We got to keep those people off the roads.
We do have the total artificial heart even now. But yeah, I know. But those are all in the early stages. And there are lots of groups thinking on those lines. And I think myocardial recovery, evolution of devices will be an interesting thing. Yeah, because of
really
organ shortage.
Yeah. I tell people this, that they don't quite understand it, but I feel like I'm part of history. You know, I'm just one stage of the development of improvement in therapies for heart failure. And I feel really good about the fact that I've been able to, you know, where our HeartMate 3 was a big improvement over HeartMate 2, you know. And so at least I was part of history with regards to that. So we can talk about this forever. This was delightful. Thank you, Dr. Nair. It's been my great honor to have you as a guest on the Heart of the Matter. This is great. We got to do this again. On behalf of myself and our listeners, I thank you so much for all that you've done in your community in Texas and the global community with your incredible dedication to your work and the heart failure global community, and for sharing this time with us. I hope we can do this again soon.
Sure. Yeah. Anytime. I'm always available, and I enjoy talking and being a part of your education.
Thank you. Yeah, and it was a pleasure for me. You explained things so nicely and so clearly, and I think all our listeners will appreciate it. So thank you again. And that is our podcast for today. Please join us next time for another intriguing, informative, and entertaining conversation. Please visit our website at www.drheart2heart.net. That's DRHEART, the numeral 2, HEART.net. For upcoming podcasts, or if you'd like me to host an online presentation for your group or organization. If you'd like to be a guest on the Heart of the Matter podcast, please email me at theheartguyspeaks@gmail.com. Our podcast can be found on Apple iTunes, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and all you have to do is search The Heart Guy Presents The Heart of the Matter and you'll find it. And until next time, this is Dr. Gary Sherman wishing you peace and hope.